This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the atrocities of 9/11, the war on terrorism generated several groups of detainees. In this country, the FBI rounded up hundreds of aliens afterwards, most of whom have since been released or deported. Following the attack in Afghanistan, thousands of men who fought for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were picked up again. Most were released, but almost 700 are imprisoned at the U.S. military base in Guantanamo, Cuba. Civil libertarians and human rights advocates have questions about the condition these people are held in, about their legal status, and if they should face trial or tribunal, whether they'll be treated fairly. And last week, two court decisions that affect the war on terrorism came down, one on the government's right to keep the identities of detainees secret, the other about the use of racial profiling, and we'll talk about those two decisions in just a moment. Later in the program, we'll focus on the alleged illegal combatants, the men being held at Camp X-Ray in Guantanamo. And after news of the death of six British soldiers in Iraq today, we'll go to London to talk about the British public and Prime Minister Tony Blair. But first, we start with the detainees, and again, this is the group of foreigners rounded up in this country after 9/11. If you have questions about their status or about the court decisions that came down that affect them, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us here in Studio 3A is Eric Lischblau, who covers the Justice Department for the New York Times. And it's good of you to come in today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with racial profiling. President Bush issued guidelines last week for when racial profiling can be used by federal agents and when it cannot. And the overall thrust or tenor of his comments was that racial profiling is a terrible thing and should not be used, except
in cases of terrorism. He set out clear exemptions, really, for terrorism and national security cases, in which he said that we still have to follow the Constitution, but if racial or ethnic information plays a part, if that helps an FBI agent in tracking down a terrorism lead, it's allowed. You can do it.
That seems to be a pretty big loophole.
The civil liberties folks and the Arab American group certainly see it as a pretty major loophole. It's a case where the government is saying that if, for instance, there's ethnic information about a certain terrorist group, and we know that a group is planning to hijack a plane in California next week, it would be permissible for agents to subject people of that ethnic group to what they call heightened scrutiny. If you're a Middle Eastern man boarding a plane in California, it's legitimate to use that information, to use that intelligence tip to try and prevent another terrorist attack. What Bush is saying is that the stakes are so high and the consequences so extraordinary that it's okay in a terrorism or national security case versus a more traditional sort of routine law enforcement case.
Well, in the statement, the president said they would only be used, racial profiling would only be used in what he said were narrow circumstances. Were these circumstances narrowed?
Well, it depends on who you ask. Arab American groups certainly see it as a form of stereotyping and profiling all Arab Americans as would-be terrorists. The government says that it will be judicious in the way it uses these standards, that the information should be followed up on to determine how credible it is, how trustworthy it is. There should not just be a blanket stereotyping of any given group, but again, that door is open.
And this is for federal guidelines.
This applies only to federal agents. There are about 70 different federal law enforcement agencies that are governed by this. There's never been an across-the-board policy before this on profiling. It was really surprisingly fragmented. Only about 7 agencies out of the 70 even had standards for when racial profiling could or could not be used. So this is an important first step, just simply in that regard.
Is it clear in the statement that racial profiling would be used prospectively? In other words, we have a certain situation and we need to go look for these people. Or could it be used retrospectively? In other words, you had no right to pick that person up and then somebody whispers in the judge's ear, national security.
It was framed mostly as a prospective means of preventing attacks. They gave several different examples, involving terrorist groups, involving the threat of a hijacked plane, involving situations like that where we are trying to stop something from happening. Therefore, that loophole kicks in.
Let's move on now to the second decision that affects detainees being held in American prisons. This one concerning whether the names of those detainees can be kept secret. Now, what happened there?
Right. Well, really, the message sent by that is largely the same as in the racial profiling, that terrorism investigations require extraordinary means by the government. And what the appellate court in Washington said was that the government was within its rights to withhold the names of more than 700 detainees who were picked up after 9/11 as part of the terrorism investigation.
Any reasons given why?
National security. What the majority of the court said, and it was a split decision, what the majority said was that in cases of national security and terrorism, we owe the government due deference to its holding that releasing these names would somehow compromise national security, and it should not be the role of the judiciary to second-guess the government in cases like that.
This is authorization for secret arrests.
Yes.
And the judiciary made no bones about that. They accepted this.
They did not. I mean, there was a strong minority opinion, and they were overruling a federal district judge who found the idea of secret arrest to be somewhat abhorrent to her, and said that this runs counter to a bedrock principle of a free and open society. But the majority said that the government has good reasons for needing to keep this information secret, and again, we're not in a position to second guess them.
Mm-hmm. Finally, we want to talk about a separate group of detainees, and by this time probably the largest group. These are being held at the U.S. military base on Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. One of your colleagues, Carlotta Gall at the New York Times, interviewed several detainees who had been released and had returned home to Pakistan, and wrote a story about conditions at Guantanamo and the treatment of the detainees there. And what can you tell us about that?
Well, over the last few months, we're starting to see a relative trickle of detainees from Guantanamo who are being released, who are returning to South Asia and elsewhere, and we're hearing reports about their treatment there. What Carlotta had found in interviews with several of these former detainees was that there were problems of numerous suicide attempts by detainees who complained about the conditions, what they considered to be sort of psychological torture, denial of religious practices and things like that. The military maintains that everyone is treated humanely, but there's obviously sharp disagreement about that, and we don't know a whole lot about the conditions for many of these people.
But from what I gather from Carlotta Gall's story, there are no allegations of physical mistreatment.
No, it's centered for the most part on just the psychological uncertainty of not knowing how long these people are going to be kept there. Many of these people have been there now for 18 months or longer, some with no end in sight. And, we're hearing several dozen who have tried to kill themselves because of what they see as just the sort of endless duration of their detention.
And some were incarcerated next to the only people who were around them with whom they could speak, spoke another language, so they felt they were completely isolated.
Right, right. That was certainly a problem. There was a problem of being in areas that were 6 feet by 8 feet long, and they were allowed out for literally only minutes each week. And so the sort of overwhelming nature of their surroundings has apparently taken its toll on some people.
In its response, the government has not been hugely forthcoming with statements about what's going on in Guantanamo, but when they do talk about it, spokesmen and women say, well, these prisoners have gained, I think, on the average, 13 pounds each, that they're working hard to improve the physical conditions in which they're being held.
Right. The government says that they're being treated well, they're being treated humanely. They do not believe that the suicide attempts they've seen are connected to their treatment per se. They think that these are probably a reflection of depression and psychological problems that they came to Cuba with. And that's a charge that human rights groups say they find a bit offensive.
Mm-hmm. They are also being treated with antidepressants in some cases?
Right, right. They're using medical treatments, sometimes in the case of after a suicide attempt, antidepressants and things like that.
Mm-hmm. And what about their concern over what is going to happen to them? Is there any indication yet at this point when or if these men are going to be tried, charged with anything, and tried, and if so, where?
Well, I think the military has begun to loosen up its policies a bit lately. As I said, over the last few months, we've begun to see people released. There's sort of an acknowledgement that not everyone who had been detained at Guantanamo was necessarily a part of the active Taliban fighting forces. For those 600 or so who are still there, I think there are still more questions than answers, though.
Well, thanks very much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Eric Lischblau is a reporter for the New York Times. He covers the Justice Department for them, and he was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. We're discussing the status of hundreds of suspected terrorists being held at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Most of the detainees there are of Middle East origin, though there are people from 42 countries overall, two from Australia. One of them is David Hicks, a 27-year-old convert to Islam who was captured fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. David's father, Terry Hicks, said in an interview that he doesn't understand why so much time has passed with no charges being filed against his son.
I believe the justification was there to start with, but as time goes on, I think that justification is now gone. They should be now starting to release them back to their own countries. I mean, it's been 15 months. That's a long time. If they still haven't got information and the ways and means they have of extracting information, then he's got nothing to say.
Terry Hicks speaking about his son David, who's been held on Guantanamo Bay for over a year and a half. We'd like to thank the Australian Broadcasting Company for letting us use that clip of tape. Joining us now is Joe Margulies. He's a lawyer who represents David Hicks and the other Australian detainee, as well as two British detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Joe Margulies joins us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for having me.
You've not been able to speak with your clients yet, have you?
No one can. That's part of the problem. And they don't even know the litigation is going on.
And why is that?
Because they are held exclusively in U.S. custody, and no one can get access to them without U.S. approval, and the United States has disallowed any contact from the outside.
They're being held incommunicado, not being able to talk with their lawyers in this respect, or even know that they have lawyers, according to the United States, at least in part because they want to facilitate the interrogations that are underway and possibly uncover further attacks against this country or others.
Right. That's the U.S. position. That's correct.
Now, there are other rules issued by the Justice Department that you have to adhere to. How are they different from the way you're used to working?
Well, now, you don't want to confuse what's going on with this litigation with the litigation that may be going on over the use of military tribunals. That's the it's the latter that the United States has issued rules governing the way those tribunals will unfold.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, there is nothing that governs it. And in fact, it is this legal limbo. Our litigation challenges the phenomenon of indefinite detention without any legal process, no process to determine whether they did anything wrong, and no process by which these people can establish their innocence.
So this,
and that's what.
Yeah, I was going to say this is what we would normally in this country call a case of habeas corpus.
That's right. And the government's position is, which has so far been endorsed by the courts, and we anticipate the Supreme Court will look at this fall, is that no court in the world has jurisdiction over what goes on in Guantanamo. And their position is oxymoronic. What they say is that within Guantanamo, Cuba is sovereign, and so therefore no U.S. court has jurisdiction. But vis-a-vis the rest of the world, the U.S. is sovereign, and therefore no international court, including no Cuban court, has jurisdiction. So you can't go anywhere to challenge the indefinite detention, despite the fact that they've never been charged and they've never been advised of any wrongdoing. And in fact, our position is, as to our clients, and as best as our investigation is able to determine, our clients have committed no wrong under domestic or international law, but there is no mechanism for them to establish their innocence. There's nowhere for them to go.
We're talking about the situation being faced at the detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. After we come back from a short break, we'll take your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. We also have an email address if you'd like to send a question or a comment that way. It's TOTN@NPR.org. We'll be back in just a moment with more from Joe Margulies, who's a lawyer for four of the men being held at Guantanamo Bay. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the status of suspected terrorists who are held at the U.S. Detention Center, Camp X-Ray, at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. If you'd like to join our discussion, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. On the line with us is Joe Margulis. He's a lawyer who represents David Hicks and another Australian detainee and two British detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay. Joe Margulis is with us from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And after discussing the conditions and sort of legal limbo in which all of these men find themselves, there is now indication that the United States is preparing, at least, to hold military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay?
That's right. Yeah, but let me jump in and correct one thing. You said that the folks that are being held down there, it's approximately 700, are suspected terrorists. Even the United States doesn't believe that. I mean, they've now recognized that the great majority of the people there were not involved in any terrorist activity. Some fraction of them, they acknowledge, are probably innocent, and at most were just either in the wrong place at the wrong time or are just sort of foot soldiers for the Taliban. Very low-level functionaries who have no intelligence value anymore. And it's important to recognize that there has to be some mechanism, some process by which you can separate and identify those who are of legitimate intelligence value and deserve to be held further and those who are not. That's the process that's missing.
So these are then the alleged illegal combatants.
Right. They have designated them enemy combatants, although that's a designation that does not affect the ability to go into court here. The reason they can't go into court is that the courts have said, as I mentioned earlier, that we don't have jurisdiction over Cuba, but no international court has jurisdiction over Guantanamo. It's this Guantanamo fiction.
So they are illegal combatants. And what are the preparations, as far as you know, that are underway to charge any of them? And they would be tried in Guantanamo?
Yes. What the United States has indicated is that they're going to have military commissions or tribunals, a very limited number, approximately a dozen. They haven't identified who will be tried. They have published the rules that should govern those tribunals. There are some really serious concerns about the fairness of those tribunals. But one of the implications of the current litigation is that because the courts have said there is no jurisdiction over that which takes place on Guantanamo, they could have these tribunals. They could be deficient in a number of respects with respect to what a fair process is supposed to be in the United States. It could, in fact, lead to a death sentence. One of the outcomes of the military tribunals could be the imposition of a death sentence under these deficient procedures. And yet there is no process for judicial review. So for the first time, we have a situation where you have a death sentence imposed in the United States, but no opportunity for any judicial review. And that's a real worrisome development.
It would be reviewed by a panel at the Defense Department and then go up through the chain of command to President Bush.
That's what it calls for right now.
Right. And there would have to be as far as I understand it, the military tribunal, the military officers would serve as a judge and jury. A majority is needed to convict, but for the death penalty, as far as I understand the rules, it would have to be unanimous.
Right. It's a 7-member panel. They have to be unanimous. They have to find it beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's not based on evidentiary standards that you and I would recognize. It's based on what is considered probative to the panel. Hearsay is admitted, but the real problem with it, the really overarching concern about the military commissions is that the defense counsel doesn't have unfettered access to the information that's used against him, because you don't have unfettered access to the client. Whenever the commission or the panel wants to close the hearing, they have a right to do that, and they can close it even to the defendant. And that which is disclosed to the military lawyer can't be shared with the client. So you can't even go to the client and say, look, this is the core piece of evidence that they are relying on in support of the death penalty. It is this fact or this cluster of facts that is most troubling. And if this is proven to be true, you are likely to be sentenced to die. It could very well be that you can't discuss that with your client, let alone investigate it outside of Cuba. That's the real concern. Well, that is one of several concerns. Given that, you need to have some mechanism for a fair and impartial review of the process, and that's what's missing.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Cole, who joins us on the line from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hi. I'd like to know, he said that the people were painted with a you know, a broad brush or that they were all in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'd like to know if you could give specific reasons why his clients were in Afghanistan when they were picked up.
Sure. In fact, three of our clients were not in Afghanistan. They were in Pakistan. Two of them did not go to Pakistan until long after the events of September 11. These are both British clients. One went there to be part of an arranged marriage. The other went there to continue his computer classes. And they were seized by Pakistani police and released to the United States. It is difficult to get more reliable information than that because the circumstances of their capture is known to the United States but has not been disclosed to us or to the courts. I cannot go down and talk to my clients and say, tell me who you were with and explore the circumstances of what you were doing, because I can't get access to my clients. What we know as best that we can reconstruct is that their families believe that, and based on their history and based on everything that we know about them, that they had, like the other people who have been released so far, no military or terrorist training. They never had anything to do with the events of 9/11. The United States has indicated, well, what the United States did in order to get these people and the events shortly after September of 11 is they went into villages where they had reports of whatever intelligence value they were, that there were Taliban sympathizers there. And they went in and they did broad sweeps, and this is what Secretary Rumsfeld has described them, broad sweeps where people were arrested and shipped off to the camps. And he is the one who has said, look, when you conduct affairs that way, you're going to get some fraction who are in the wrong place at the wrong time. We hope, as he said, that there would be some process by which you can separate those. Well, that's what's been missing. And all we know is that there have been approximately 25 of 700 people, there have been approximately 25 released, who they have said, these are an example of ones who are in the wrong place at the wrong time. We made a mistake as to these people. The problem is there is no process by which you do it for the other 675. And it's the U.S. position that they can be held there indefinitely. And their position is they can be held there as long as the United States sees fit. And the best way to appreciate the significance of this is just to imagine this. Imagine there were 700 U.S. citizens held in some facility somewhere around the world in a country that we either had relations with or we did not. And the position of that government was, we can hold these people with no process given and no process contemplated for as long as we want, and you cannot complain to any court in the world. And if you don't like it, get over it, because that's the government's position.
Cole, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Joe Margulies, stay with us. We'd like to bring in another guest to discuss these set of issues with you. John Yu is a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He specializes in national security law. He's currently a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, which enables him to join us here in Studio 3A. Good to see you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here.
You've been listening to the conversation. What's your view on the set of rules set up by the Justice Department regarding the people being held at Guantanamo?
Well, the first thing to make clear is that military commissions are not part of the judicial process of our domestic court system. They are an aspect of the president's war power. And as such, there is no need for judicial review of their conduct outside the United States when they're used vis-a-vis enemy aliens who fought against the United States and the trials are not taking place in the United States. And the Supreme Court has reviewed these cases historically. The most recent and significant case is called Johnson versus Eisentrager at the end of World War II, and the Supreme Court has said when you hold enemy aliens outside the United States, like at Guantanamo Bay, and you try them with a military commission, there is no judicial review of the process because this is part of the President's Commander-in-Chief authority. Given that the rules that have been issued by the Defense Department for military commissions have, I think, been very fair. They're modeled on the rules that apply in court-martials, which, you know, are used on our own servicemen and servicewomen when they commit crimes against the Code of Military Justice. I think many of the things that Mr. Margulies said are an attempt to use the rules that apply to the civilian law enforcement system, which is used here in the United States when someone's already committed a crime and you're going to try them, and trying to import them into this military area, which is part of the president's commander-in-chief power, not really part of, you know, the federal court process at all.
Yet there's a certain, you know, fairness here. I mean, these people are being held. They don't know if they're going to be charged. If so, when that will happen, how long they're going to be detained. That somebody represents them. They don't know that. They're not able to talk to their lawyers. They're held in this legal limbo, and you don't wonder why dozens have attempted suicide.
Well, again, I think that's the reason that seems like such a cognitive dissonance to people is that's because we think of it as a law enforcement problem in the United States where you get Miranda and attorneys, you're charged, and then after trial, you finally are detained, and the detention is a punishment. In the war system, these people are just being held because they're fighting against us. They're not being punished in their detention. The detention is just there to prevent them from continuing to fight against us. Just like in World War II, we held hundreds of thousands of Germans and Japanese and Italian prisoners of war. They didn't all get attorneys. You know, they didn't all get to go to the federal court system.
But they got the protection of being prisoners of war. These men don't have that.
Right, and that's because of the way they chose to fight. I mean, they are not fighting on behalf of a nation. They are terrorists. They are fighting almost as free agents. And so they're not protected by that treaty because they're not part of a country that ever signed the treaty. But, you know, the important point is that they can be held until the war is over. There are still rules here. They're just different kinds of rules. The Geneva Conventions, even if they apply, they don't give you an attorney. But they do say when the war is over, then you're released. But there's no trial process here because they're not being punished. They're just being held so they don't hurt anybody else until the war is over.
Well, the president said major combat is over in Afghanistan. Isn't that the war being over?
Well, see, I think there's two wars here. There was the war against the Taliban in Afghanistan, which is still continuing. It's just major combat operations are over, but that doesn't mean the conflict as a legal matter is over. And then there's the conflict against Al-Qaeda, which continues and has not, you know, come anywhere close to an end of major combat operations. And, you know, Congress authorized the president to conduct this war against Al-Qaeda in its joint resolution right after September 11th. And all the lower courts that have confronted these kind of cases have also found that there is a war against Al-Qaeda that was started on September 11th at least, and that we can use the government's war powers to fight them.
Let's get a call in. Jen joins us on the line from Philadelphia.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Jen. It is you. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just curious, and this is going to reveal a lot of my historical ignorance, I guess, but I was wondering if your expert could talk about the similarities and differences between the internment of the Japanese in our country during World War II and what's the internment in Guantanamo. And I think I understand some of the differences, but I wondered maybe if you could expound on that.
Well,
is there anything to expound on?
Okay. Joe Margulis, did you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, sure. The internments of the Japanese were pursuant to an executive order that was later codified in a statute. So you begin with there was a process. More significantly, when the Supreme Court eventually considered it, though they upheld the internments in one case, at the same time that they upheld it, they authorized a habeas review in another case that allowed detainees to come in and say, look, you should not detain me because I am innocent. I am not disloyal. And so the important thing is that even in that circumstance, there was a process by which a person could establish their innocence and secure their release. Even with that process, however, the United States has now broadly recognized that the internment of the Japanese was one of the most embarrassing and shameful moments in our history and has made formal reparations and apologies both by Congress and the president. In this case, by contrast, these are people held in an area that is subject to exclusive and complete U.S. control that we have controlled for a century now. Yet they take the position that you cannot go to any court in the world to demonstrate your innocence and secure your release. And so that is one of the principal differences. It is, for the first time in modern history, since the development of the laws of war, the first time that the United States has held people seized during armed conflict without some process by which you can establish your innocence. And so what Professor Yu was pointing out is to say that they are terrorists and therefore we have a right to detain them. Well, that is sort of assumes the fact in issue. The point is, whenever there is a detention made, there is a process. And of course, it's true, you don't have to have a civilian process, but you have to have some process by which you can establish these facts. In other words, this is an adjudicated fact, not one decreed by executive fiat. The other point that, if I could just respond
very
to
quickly, if you would, yeah.
Sure. He says that the commissions are based on the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Well, of course, that's true, but they are deficient in so many respects relative to that. The most important being that you don't have access to your client, and the client doesn't have access to the information against him. And, of course, in the UCMJ, you do. You also have a jury of 12 in death cases in the UCMJ, and you only have a jury of 7, and it doesn't even have to be unanimous for non-death cases. There are important differences between these rules and the UCMJ.
Jen, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks so much for talking about the topic. I appreciate it.
Okay. And Joe Margulis, thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Not at all. Thanks for your time.
Joe Margulis is counsel for 4 detainees held at Guantanamo Bay. He was with us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we want to get back to the discussion of the decisions that were announced last week on racial profiling and secret arrests. John Yu, a law professor at the University of California, Berkeley, is still with us here in Studio 3A. And joining us now is Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies. She was lead plaintiff for the center, which was part of a broad coalition that challenged the secret detentions policy. And she joins us on the phone from her office here in Washington. Good of you to be with us.
Good afternoon.
Now, your organization wanted the names and other information about the detainees released by the Justice Department. Again, we're referring to the group of people, foreigners, aliens, if you will, who were picked up after 9/11. You must have been disappointed by last week's ruling.
We were. You know, what happened, of course, is the Justice Department arrested 1,000 people in secret inside the United States. It's the first time in U.S. history that any court has sanctioned secret arrests. And, you know, we disagree, obviously, with the result of the decision. There was a good dissenting opinion, and we are planning to appeal the decision.
So you're going to take it back to court?
Yes.
And is the appeals court the next level?
We have a choice between asking the full appeals court to hear the case or to ask the Supreme Court to hear the case, and we'll have to make that decision in the next few weeks.
So this is going to be a matter of legal tactics. John Yu, if you would join us on this, what's your, again, secret arrests seem outside, American experience.
Yeah, I don't think these are fairly called secret arrests. All of the people who are detained, the 700
They were arrested. Their names weren't released. Those are
right.
secret
they were,
arrests.
Their names weren't released, but they all had been here in violation of the INS laws. They all had access to a lawyer. They're all presented in a hearing before a magistrate. They were all themselves individually free to talk to the press or to the public if they so chose. What the government didn't want to do is to provide an accumulated list of all the people, all the charges, the dates they were picked up, the dates they were released, who their lawyers were, and for the reason that was given in the decision itself, that when you look at the world of intelligence, the government is trying to accumulate a mosaic of everything the other side is up to. And they're doing the same thing to us. Information like that would be extremely valuable to Al-Qaeda in trying to figure out several things. For example, who their operatives are in the United States that have been captured, which people haven't been captured. They can figure out, look at the parents, figure out what sources of theirs we've been able to break into, which communications we've been able to tap into, and where we're barking up the wrong tree. And so it's not the case that we're arrested secretly and hidden away. It's that the government didn't want to give more information than necessary to the other side.
We're going to continue discussing this after a break. Our phone number again, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Our guests are John Yu, a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and Kate Martin of the Center for National Security Studies. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing how two decisions that were announced last week, one allowing racial profiling in some circumstances involving terrorism, the other which allows the Justice Department to keep identities of people arrested, foreigners arrested in terrorist roundups secret. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@npr.org. Our guests are John Yu, who's a law professor at the University of California at Berkeley. He specializes in national security law, and Kate Martin, director of the Center for National Security Studies. And Kate, I wanted to get back to you and the idea that we're talking about these secret arrests, and where can, was any part of the government's case compelling to you?
No, although when we filed the case initially back in the fall of 2001, we didn't know whether or not what the government had, in fact, done was find some number of terrorists. But what we discovered through, which then makes the case harder, perhaps, but here's what we know now. Mr. Yu's claim that these weren't secret arrests is simply untrue. While he and his colleagues at the Justice Department, he was one of the architects of this policy, claimed that nobody was denied the right to a lawyer and everyone had the right to tell people they'd been arrested. 2 weeks ago, the Justice Department's own Inspector General released a report outlining that people were held incommunicado by order of the highest people in the Justice Department for days, weeks, and months denied the right to see a lawyer. The other fact that we have to have out here is the Justice Department was asked in our lawsuit repeatedly for their justification for doing this in secret. They never said that these people were connected to terrorism. They never claimed one of them were. Now, there's more than 700. We don't know exactly how many. A handful of them may well be connected to terrorism. Hundreds of them have apparently no connection to terrorism. So the government's argument is that somehow giving out the fact that it has arrested a lot of people who, while they are Arabs or Muslims, have no connection with terrorism, would somehow give some useful information to al-Qaeda. We have become more and more convinced that what is going on here is a cover-up of the fact that the criteria used for jailing people, these people incommunicado, was either their ethnicity or their religion.
Which gets back to racial profiling to some degree. John, you have a response?
Yes, I think the other thing the IG report showed was that there was no systematic policy to deny everybody a lawyer, to detain everybody incommunicado. I think what the report shows is that
it did find abuses.
Yes, it found abuses, but it wasn't the result of a policy or some kind of systematic order. It's more the case that whenever you have any kind of government implementing a policy, you're going to have people who don't follow all the rules. That doesn't mean the policy itself is wrong. It'd be like saying you have some abuse by officers in prison, prison guard abuse, but that doesn't mean you get rid of prisons. I mean, it's just the case that there were incidents where there was abuses, but not that it was the intention of the government as a policy matter to do any of these things.
Can I just respond to that? The whole problem, you know, the terrible thing about secret arrests and why we have openness in a country like this is that secrecy invites government abuse. You know, there is no example in history where a government has been allowed to secretly arrest people, quote, in the name of history, where they haven't abused their rights. You know, that's what happens when you have secret arrests and you do so in the name of national security.
Well, let's get a listener back involved. Ted joins us on the line from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah, it's very ominous to me that apparently the Justice Department or the Defense Department can simply label somebody a terrorist and they don't need to present any evidence for that. And so I'd like your guest to react to that, but I have an observation here. I don't think this should come as any surprise given the fact that throughout history, religious fundamentalists have tended to be very sadistic and very cruel in their application of rules and laws. And when you look at John Ashcroft, he's a Pentecostal. They speak in tongues. What we have here in the Justice Department is a religious fanatic who is most probably psychologically disturbed, who speaks in tongues. So why should we be surprised that that this is happening when we have at the very top of the Justice Department a man who is most likely a very disturbed individual?
Ted, I'm not sure we're going to psychoanalyze the Attorney General of the United States on this program. I think your first question, though, is a good one, and I'll turn to John Yoo about that. I mean, he's right. It is ominous if anybody can be labeled a terrorist without evidence.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think people can be held as enemy combatants. There was one designated as such by the Defense Department yesterday, Mr. Almari. There's only been two others, Mr. Padilla and Mr. Hamdi. In all those cases, in the first two cases, the United States has welcomed habeas corpus review by a federal court, and the United States has presented the evidence to the judge about why we thought this person was an enemy combatant and why we're detaining them. You know, that's exactly how the system should work, and the United States has not fought. In fact, it's welcomed having courts review because we want the public to have confidence in the fact that we are operating within the rules and within the law.
But once again, that's not exactly correct. What the Justice Department's position has been in the case of the enemy combatants is we will give a conclusory affidavit saying that this guy is a member of al-Qaeda when a lawyer who's never been allowed to talk to the guy says, wait a minute, I need to talk to my client to be able to put in an affidavit that would, for example, say, you know what, you're confusing me with someone else. I never was there. I never this, that, or the other. The Justice Department's response has been, the court has no business looking at that. If we say he's an enemy combatant, that is enough, it's the end of the matter. And that, I suggest to you, is can only be described as judicial review with some kind of Orwellian view of what judicial review is.
John?
I don't think that's quite right. I think what we've done, for example, in the Fourth Circuit is we have gone to the courts, we have presented evidence. The courts have sometimes asked for more evidence. In the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the court found that we had given sufficient evidence to find the person, enemy combatant.
The dispute was never allowed.
Let me just finish. The dispute in the Second Circuit over Mr. Padilla is not over our power to detain his enemy combatant or how we were going about doing it. There is the argument about whether you have access as a lawyer to the client. I think that the government has a reasonable argument there, which is the whole point of this is to get information from the detainees, from the enemy combatants, to stop future terrorist attacks. An attorney who's introduced into the process will advise his client not to talk. And the presence of a third independent party who's going to block the interrogations from proceeding is going to be very damaging to the United States. So we're trying to come up with a compromise. And that compromise is instead of having an attorney with access to that client, we're going to provide all the information that the court wants to see to the court in making a habeas corpus determination. And the litigation is mostly about how much of that evidence do we show.
Let's see if we get one more question in on this. Gabe joins us on the line from Boston.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that your guest, I think Mr. Yu, has said a couple things along the lines of speaking of different practices, like civilian practices in the U.S., like Miranda rights, as mm-hmm. if they were abstractions or just words, saying, well, it's technically, you know, these don't need to apply or whatever. And this is certainly the position of the administration, but these are not abstractions. These are things which are in our government, which make the United States a wonderful place in general to live. And you know, the Miranda rights or the right to an attorney or the right to be arrested and know what's going on, these are natural human rights. Anyone who has common sense can say, you know, no matter what the crime, we need to protect these things. And the kind of abstraction, the disconnect between words and meaning, which seems to be peddled on so many issues by this administration, is really terrifying.
Well, Gabe, let's get a quick response if we can.
I share your like of all these rules as they apply in the domestic legal system. The issue here is that we are fighting an enemy, and the people we're talking about are enemy combatants who are being held out overseas after they've tried to attack the United States. We don't give Miranda and attorney rights to the Germans and Japanese who were captured during World War II. We didn't give them to every Iraqi we captured in the war that's just completed. There's just a different set of rules that apply in wartime as opposed to United States citizens in the United States.
Kate Martin, I know you probably have an argument to come back with, but I'm afraid we're out of time in this segment, and we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Kate Martin is director of the Center for National Security Studies. She was with us on the phone from her office here in Washington. John Yu, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
John Yu, law professor at the University of California at Berkeley, a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He joined us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.